This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Israel and the Middle East, after Sharon. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is To the Point for Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Despite three brain surgeries in less than a week, Ariel Sharon shows signs of life, but his own surgeon says he will not return as Prime Minister of Israel. Palestinians may be glad to see him go, but for Israelis, Sharon created the hope of unity behind withdrawal from Gaza and parts of the West Bank. On To the Point, we'll hear about prospective successors and their chances of holding Israelis together. We'll get a Palestinian perspective and look at the options available to the Bush administration. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Microsoft, the Internet, and censorship in mainland China. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Ariel Sharon is still alive, but doctors say his role as prime minister has come to an end. On To the Point, we'll hear about prospective successors, get a Palestinian perspective, and look at options for the Bush administration. On Reporter's Notebook, Microsoft has shut down an internet blog that angered officials in China. We'll hear about the role of Western companies in enforcing censorship. First, this news update. Appellate Judge Samuel Alito got a White House send-off from President Bush this morning. Then he listened as Judiciary Committee members of both parties made their opening statements. Here's Republican Charles Grassley of Iowa.
I am hopeful that his commitment to judicial restraint and to confining decisions to the law and the Constitution will shine through in this hearing, and I believe it will.
Democrat Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts raised concerns based on executive power and constitutional checks and balances.
In an era where the White House is abusing power, is excusing and authorizing torture, and is spying on American citizens, I find Judge Alito's support for an all-powerful executive branch to be genuinely troubling.
After the committee members have held forth, Alito himself will get his turn. Dahlia Lithwick is watching it all. She's senior editor at Slate.com. Dahlia, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
You have written very recently about this issue just raised, as we heard, by Senator Kennedy today, and the question of executive power. How has that come to be so important in the Alito confirmation when we didn't hear much about it with the now Chief Justice Roberts?
Well, I think it's gone from being a sort of theoretical problem, Warren, that is to say, some of the senators, I'm remembering Russ Feingold, was very concerned sort of theoretically about sort of executive excessive during wartime, during the Roberts hearing. But now it's sort of been concretized. We have an actual incident in which, unbeknownst to us, for years the president has been authorizing, warrantless wiretaps of American citizens. And he felt that it was fine, and he oversaw the program, and he kept determining whether, checking in and determining whether those wiretaps were continued to be authorized. So you have a sort of one branch of government arrogating it to itself enormous power. And that really gives, I think, the members of the committee something to wrap their heads around. They can say, look, this isn't just a theoretical problem. We have an actual situation in which the executive branch really sees absolutely no limits to executive power during wartime. And I think that quote you just played from Senator Kennedy really goes to this notion of we need to know if you are going to, once you replace Sandra Day O'Connor, be the buffer against that. And one of the most interesting things I'm noticing here in the Hart building today is over and over and over again, Democrats in the committee are quoting that line, O'Connor's famous line from the Humvee opinion, the war power is not a grant of a blank check to the president. Over and over again, they feel that that's the seat that's going to be filled by someone who is much, much, much less concerned about executive overreaching.
Well, what do we know about Judge Alito's decisions on this issue?
Well, we don't know too too much about his actual views on executive powers, unlike John Roberts, who actually sat on the Hamdan case, which involves the Guantanamo detainees. We don't have opinions from him as a judge on this, but we do have many, many, many opinions in which he invariably sides with the state, sides with the police, sides with the prosecutors, sides against the defendant, sides against the person claiming that their civil liberties have been encroached. So I don't think we have a clear sense of where he is on executive power, although we certainly have things that he's written when he worked for the executive branch, which suggests obviously a very broad view of executive power. Maybe that's okay. That's what someone who works for the executive would advocate. But in his sort of neutral roles as an umpire, as a judge calling balls and strikes, we know that this is a guy who very, very, very overwhelmingly sides with the state against the individual who's claiming that their civil liberties have been encroached. And I think that is something we need to really watch and to hope that he can answer to.
Dahlia Lithwick, once again, is senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. What about abortion and Roe versus Wade?
Well, again, you know, we're watching opening statements, so there's an awful lot of sort of chest bumping going on. But the Democrats on the committee are saying, you know, look, you tell us in private meetings that you respect stare decisis, you respect the notion that this case has been around a long time, but in your private writings, most famously in 1985 job application, you say the Constitution doesn't, you know, create a right to abortion. Which is it? And then, you know, interestingly, on the political right, we're not hearing a lot about that, but certainly a little bit inklings we're hearing of, you know, even though it's precedent and even though you believe in stare decisis, if you think Roe was wrongly decided, Judge Alito, you go ahead and reverse it. So it's interesting. It's sort of bubbling up a little bit on the political right and quite explicit on the political left.
We're out of time, but the Senate hearings are expected to go on now for how long?
Well, they're saying through Friday, possibly Saturday, if the Democrats really, really want to wrestle this to the ground. So we will see. It may be a long week.
All right. Once again, Judge Samuel Alito to be the replacement of Sandra Day O'Connor, who is retiring. He, of course, needs confirmation first by the Senate committee, then by the Senate as a whole. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks as always for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren. Have a good day.
Senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. In a moment, Israel and the Middle East after Sharon on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. Ariel Sharon is able to breathe on his own. He has responded to pain tests in the arm and leg. But the neurosurgeon who conducted three brain surgeries last week says that Sharon will not be able to continue as Prime Minister of Israel. It will take days to awaken him from an induced coma, and doctors will then pass their assessments to the Attorney General. Until Sharon is finally declared incapacitated, his chair will be left empty at cabinet meetings, as it was yesterday, with Ehud Olmert presiding as acting Prime Minister. Yossi Klein-Halevi is senior fellow at the Shalem Center. That's a conservative think tank. He's also foreign correspondent for the New Republic magazine in this country. Yossi Klein-Halevi, as always, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Is there, given the crucial importance of this role and the fact that under the law, once permanent disability is declared, a new prime minister has to be chosen by the cabinet in 24 hours, is there dispute about heroic measures to prolong what appears to be inevitable?
The heroic measures, as you describe them, are separate in the public's mind from the workings of the system. The Israeli democratic system went into high gear as soon as Sharon developed his massive stroke, and it is acting independently of whatever happens to Sharon in terms of his health. Whatever recovery Sharon is going to make, if he makes any recovery at all, is going to be so slow, so agonizingly slow, that as far as the Israeli public is concerned, the next prime minister is already in place.
And that is?
Well, the acting prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who was Sharon's designated successor. And one of the most remarkable aspects of this very difficult last week was how smoothly the Israeli political system has functioned, to the extent where there's been no bickering within Sharon's new party, which is remarkable given the fact that the parliamentary list and the order of candidates was something that Sharon had drawn up but not revealed. So that list is really locked in Sharon's head. And nevertheless, there has been almost no infighting, no struggling for power within this nascent party. And the system has operated with a level of maturity which I think has surprised the Israelis themselves.
And what does that suggest, given how recently Kadima was formed? And as you said, the fact that it still exists in many ways as an idea in the prime minister's head.
Well, I think it says two things. One, about the maturity of the system, that Israeli democracy has weathered far more traumatic moments than this one, even though the passing of Prime Minister Shamir, Prime Minister Sharon from the scene is a deeply traumatic event. Nevertheless, we did weather an assassination 10 years ago, and the system not only continued but probably got stronger because of its ability to persevere. And that's the first point. The second point is that Kadima represents a real need in the Israeli political system. For the first time, there exists a strong centrist party to represent what I would argue is a new Israeli majority that has despaired of the quick fix solutions of both left and right, and is looking for an alternative between endless occupation as proposed by the right and a dead-end peace process, which is still being touted by the left. Kadima's approach, which began with unilateral withdrawal in Gaza, was that it's up to Israel to end the occupation and find safe borders on its own, given the absence of a credible Palestinian partner.
Yossi Klein-Halevi, once again, senior fellow at the Shalem Center, foreign correspondent for the New Republic magazine. Uri Dromi is a former senior aide to two prime ministers, Yitzhak Rabin, he who was assassinated 10 years ago, as just mentioned, and Shimon Peres, who is now a member of the Kadima parties. Now, Uri Dromi is now with the Israel Democracy Institute, and thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you for hosting me.
Shimon Peres was, at the outset at least, at the end of last week, thought to be one of the possible problems for Kadima if he were to challenge Mr. Olmert for leadership. It appears now he has not doing that. How important is that?
It's very important. As Yossi Klein-Halevi said, one of the most important things that happened to Kadima is that its leaders didn't start immediately the ego trip. There was a little scene with Shimon Peres about his place, I think, his authorities or whatever. But I think even today, I think I saw him on television affirming his allegiance to Kadima and Olmert, because there were talks he might return to Labor. Shimon Peres is an asset because people respect him. People, by the way, don't elect him as number one, but people would love to see him as number two because of his experience and statesmanship. So I think now things are pretty settled there, and he can really become an asset.
What about Labor and the possibility that it would have tried, or that it is still trying, to lure Shimon Peres back? He was prime minister, a Labor prime minister himself, and again, you served as his aide. Is that now a dead issue?
I think it is. He, I tell you, 10 minutes ago I saw him on television saying, and, you know, if after what I heard he would decide to go back to Labor, then whatever left of his credibility is gone. I think he will stay in Kadima, but I see the future government based on a coalition of Kadima and Labor Therefore, Shimon Peres will be there this way or another.
What about what we just heard from Yossi Klein Halevi, that there is a new majority and that Kadima represents that and that they are rejecting both the endless occupation that he says is what the Likud really is talking about, or what he referred to as the dead-end peace process, which has been Labor's goal? How do you react to that?
I agree with that. As a matter of fact, what seemed to be like a great and bold move by Sharon was by pulling out of Gaza was bold indeed, but definitely it reflected the mood of the Israelis who really are fed up with the endless, as Yossi said, occupation on one hand and the open-ended peace approach of the left. But Sharon was really, I hate to talk about him in past tense, but I still hope he will recover. But his policy was really unilateralism, realizing there's no credible partner. I'm not sure about the coming leadership that we're going to have. I think Ehud Olmert is more pragmatic. Tzipi Livni is more pragmatic. And, of course, Shimon Peres is always for negotiations. So I think there will be a cautious attempt to resume talks with the Palestinians. But then, of course, much depends on how the Palestinians themselves react. We have elections coming soon there. And it remains to be seen what kind of form the Palestinians will decide to put forward.
We'll be getting a Palestinian voice on our program a little bit later. Meantime, we're talking with Uri Dromi, former aide to Prime Ministers Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, and Yossi Klein Halevi. Let me go back to Yossi Klein Halevi again with the Shalem Center and the New Republic. If, in fact, Kadima forms a coalition with Labor, doesn't that suggest that the peace process, particularly if Shimon Peres is the number two in the government, is still pretty much alive?
In order to have a credible peace process, you need a credible partner. And our options at this point seem to be between a Palestinian Authority led by Fatah, which would give us anarchy, corruption, toleration of terrorism, and incitement against Israel's right to exist. That's the Fatah option. The Hamas option of a Hamas-led Palestinian Authority would be no corruption, discipline, no anarchy, fundamentalist terrorism, and, of course, incitement against Israel's legitimacy. So that when your average Israeli looks at those two unpalatable choices, the inevitable conclusion is that the unilateral process that Sharon began in Gaza needs to continue on the West Bank, because we're not likely to find a credible partner with whom to conclude a comprehensive agreement. Most Israelis would prefer an agreement with the Palestinians to unilateralism. If we're already giving up territory, then we should be getting something in return. That's the natural response of most Israelis. Nevertheless, given what is happening in Palestine, given the implosion of what is clearly becoming a failed state, a stillborn state, I think that the general conclusion almost across the board, again, leaving out the hard left and the hard right, is that we're going to need to continue proceeding with caution to the next stage of unilateralism.
Uri Dromi, back to you. Do you see this in the same way that Yossi Klein Halevi does, that we have not just a failed state, but a stillborn state that's never going to provide a credible partner?
I wouldn't bury the Palestinian viable state so quickly. I share Yossi's concerns about where the Palestinians might go, but I think we owe ourselves and our next generation another attempt, another try. All the polls show that is the Fatah going to win, but with the Hamas having a sizable minority there. And I think we need to give the Palestinians a chance to start a process of nation building, to say that their failed state is easy because then it's finished. I think Israel should always maintain its security, and the option of unilateralism is always there. But to start with this, we started with Gaza. That was easy. I think we still have time, or we still need another chance to test the intentions of the Palestinians. And if it fails, then there's always a time for unilateralism.
Again, Uri Dromi is now with the Israel Democracy Institute. Today, Mahmoud Abbas, who is, of course, the leader of the Palestinian Authority and of the Fatah faction, says that he has received assurances from Condoleezza Rice and a message from President Bush that the Palestinians will be allowed to campaign in East Jerusalem. That had been an issue. If that is the case, has not been confirmed, apparently, by either the Israeli or American governments. Palestinian elections then will go forward as planned very soon. Yossi Klein Halevi, what do you expect to happen? And if the process does go forward, do you still see that there's simply no satisfactory outcome as far as Israelis are concerned?
I think at this point we're going through the motions. I understand Uri's point. I want to grasp at hope as well. When Mahmoud Abbas came in last year, I wrote a very optimistic piece for the New Republic, which I look back now and I'm a bit embarrassed about. We here in Israel always grasp at straws, but the straws are becoming smaller and thinner. If you look at what has happened as a result of the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in terms of how it affects the roadmap, what Sharon did was essentially go to the very end of the roadmap, which calls for dismantling Israeli settlements and allowing for the emergence of a Palestinian state. He tested the roadmap, or the very last premise of the roadmap, in microcosm in Gaza. At the same time, the Palestinian leadership, and we're not talking about Hamas, we're talking about the moderate Fatah mainstream leadership, has not yet begun to implement the very first point of the roadmap, which calls for disarming the terrorists and controlling the terrorist infrastructure. And so long as we're in an almost surrealistic situation, in which Israel, at least on one front, on the Gaza front, has already concluded the roadmap, whereas the Palestinian leadership has not yet begun to implement the roadmap, then I don't see any possibility for holding out the hope, which at this point is just one more illusion that we've inherited from the Oslo era.
All right. We're going to have to take a brief break. Meantime, or in a moment, rather, we will continue. Yossi Klein Halevi, thanks to being with us with the Shalem Center and the New Republic. Uri Dromi is going to continue with us. We will hear in a moment a Palestinian voice. We'll also talk to Dennis Ross, the former ambassador for Middle Eastern Affairs for President Clinton and the first Bush administration. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Microsoft, the Internet, and censorship in mainland China. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Alnibak with To the Point. Once again, Ariel Sharon is able to breathe on his own. He has responded to pain tests in his right arm and leg. But the neurosurgeon who conducted three brain surgeries last week says he will not be able to continue as the Prime Minister of Israel. And we are talking today about the Middle East in his absence. Muin Rabbani is Palestinian Affairs Analyst for the International Crisis Group. That's a non-governmental organization. He himself is of Palestinian descent. Mr. Rabbani, thanks for coming back on our program.
Pleasure to be with you.
What is the view, or has been the view, of Palestinians in particular and Middle East Muslims in general of Ariel Sharon?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Sharon was far and away the most reviled Israeli of his generation among Palestinians. And that, of course, reflects the very bloody relationship between Sharon and the Palestinians since the 1950s. Among Palestinians, Arabs more generally, his name is synonymous with a whole host of bloody events, including massacres such as Sabra and Shatila, the repression of the uprising during the past 4 years, and so on. So I think it would be fair to say that for Palestinians, and indeed for Arabs, he's come to symbolize, personify even, that which they most hate about Israel.
We have heard earlier on our program from two sources, Yossi Klein Halevi and Uri Dromi, both of whom I'm sure you are familiar with, saying that he's come to represent a new majority in Israel, fed up with occupation, fed up with what they, one of them at least referred to as a dead-end peace process, and now favoring a kind of unilateral Israeli resolution of the border problems in particular. How does that go down with Palestinians?
Well, I think to an extent that's a fair observation. I think that Sharon represents new Israeli consensus, which is that the way, which is that this conflict no longer needs to be resolved through negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians to reach a mutually agreeable and durable compromise, but rather that Israel, having largely achieved a military victory over the Palestinians, can now unilaterally determine the shape of a permanent settlement and basically impose its will on the Palestinians. Now, as we've seen in Gaza over the past year, that doesn't mean that Israel gets to keep everything. Sharon withdrew from the Gaza Strip and demolished Israeli settlements there, while at the same time, of course, building the separation wall in the West Bank, confiscating at least as much land in the West Bank as he evacuated in the Gaza Strip. But the underlying idea is not that there is no Palestinian partner. I think the operative concept is rejecting a Palestinian partner, not only Arafat, but also Abbas, or for that matter, anyone else, because Sharon's view is we don't need a peace agreement, we don't want one, and Israel can basically impose stability and achieve security without reaching an agreement with the Palestinians.
What is the situation in the Palestinian territories at this point? Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah and the PLO has said that the Bush administration has assured him that there will be allowed campaigning in East Jerusalem. That had been a major issue for him. Do you think that that's right? It hasn't been confirmed by either the Israelis or the Americans, apparently, and that the election will go forward then. And is his faction or Hamas most likely to win?
Well, my understanding is that Israel has agreed to allow Palestinian candidates, or at least Palestinian candidates who are not members of Hamas, to campaign in Jerusalem, and it has not yet given a clear response on whether it will permit voting to take place or not in East Jerusalem. But I think if these elections are again postponed, which I think is a very real possibility, it's likely to have less to do with Israeli interference or foreign threats about, you know, how they might deal with the PA should Hamas perform very well. And I think it will be more of a reflection of the growing instability and chaos within the occupied territories, in which you have very powerful forces who seem determined to sabotage these elections, basically because they're going to lose power. And having failed to achieve a formal postponement of these elections, they're now seeking to make it functionally impossible to conduct them later this month. I mean, this is also something, you know, that is also related to Sharon's policies towards the Palestinians, because he has so weakened the PA over the past few years and undermined its ability to impose law and order in Palestinian population centers, that I think that has to be part of the explanation. But at the end of the day, whether elections are held or not reflects internal Palestinian dynamics more than anything else.
Muin Rabbani, Palestinian Affairs Analyst for the International Crisis Group. Dennis Ross was U.S. point man on the peace process for President Clinton and for the first President Bush. He's now counselor and distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Dennis Ross, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
What opportunities are there now for the Bush administration? And is there, do you think, a change in American policy in the offing, so dependent as it was, on Ariel Sharon?
Well, I think there'll have to be because, in a sense, we operated with a kind of luxury. The luxury was that Sharon would come up with the initiatives, Sharon was the driver of the policy, and we would simply respond to what Sharon was doing. And I disagree with what I just heard in one respect, at least, on what was driving Sharon and the consensus in Israel. The consensus in Israel believes, you can agree with them or disagree with them, but they believe that there isn't a Palestinian partner, that there's such dysfunction on the Palestinian side that there is not just a combination of chaos and lawlessness, but also there still isn't a real acceptance of making peace with Israel, that you can't, in fact, have a negotiated solution. All you can do is, in a sense, be done with the Palestinian problem. And what the consensus, and I would say it's 70% of the Israeli public, has wanted, and Sharon came to both reflect and demonstrate that he would act on, is, in effect, to separate from the Palestinians, to disassociate from the Palestinians. So that's what produced unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. And had Sharon been reelected, it would have produced, I think, a significant unilateral move on the West Bank as well. Now, the American administration, the Bush administration, I think, has been governed largely by an expectation that that process of unilateralism would continue. And as long as Sharon was at the helm, it was, I think, ready to put itself in a position where we would simply respond to what he was doing. He wanted, I think, much more to reach an agreement with us as opposed to trying to reach an agreement with the Palestinians. And in effect, the administration was, I think, prepared to go down that road. Now it's going to be harder, I think, to do that because assuming Ehud Olmert succeeds him, which is still a question mark, but it's certainly a possibility, while he, too, is a believer in disengagement and in many ways was ahead of Sharon on that, you can't look at him as being able to move as quickly or having the capability or the clout or the authority to be able to do the kinds of things that Sharon would have done. So I think it requires much more initiative by the administration and not just a position where we wait to see what Sharon wants to do and then support what he's doing.
What about what we heard a moment ago from Muin Rabbani, that in fact Sharon was instrumental in weakening the Palestinian Authority and the Fatah movement so that he ended up with a kind of with what he wanted, which was chaos and confusion that allowed him then to take a unilateral approach to all of this?
Well, I think that lets too much of the responsibility for this reside only on the Israeli side, and I think a lot has to reside on the Palestinian side. You know, the fact that the character of the Israeli presence in Gaza was completely different than the character of its presence in the West Bank, and so they didn't weaken the Palestinian Authority so much within Gaza. And the fact is, Israel then got out of Gaza. Now, I can tell you from my days as a negotiator, frequently the Palestinians would say, well, we can't do certain things because the Israelis are preventing us from doing it. Well, the Israelis are out of Gaza. And what we've seen after the Israelis got out of Gaza is there's a problem because there aren't decisions made by the Palestinian Authority. I think one of the problems that Abu Mazen has had is that he's not used the leverage that he had based on the elections that gave him an authority. I think we let him down in some ways because we didn't provide the kind of assistance, material assistance on the ground that would have put people back to work and that would have built his authority more. But the fact is he's also not made decisions when he could have made decisions. He's not acted when he could have acted. So I think, you know, maybe there's something to what the Israelis did, especially as it relates to the West Bank in terms of weakening the authority. But you can't really say the same thing for Gaza. And the fact of the matter is, with Israel out of Gaza, there really is no excuse, and the Palestinians, I think, have to bear some of the brunt of this.
Dennis Ross, former negotiator for the United States. Back to Muin Rabbani, Palestinian Affairs Analyst at the International Crisis Group. What about Ehud Olmert, and do you think that under these circumstances he is likely to go the same way that Prime Minister Sharon was going? Is that good or bad for the Palestinians?
Well, many people have credited Olmert with having, in fact, having been the first to develop these ideas, which Sharon later adopted and implemented. I don't think the question is whether one should positively or negatively judge a subsequent Israeli withdrawal from parts of the West Bank. and whether Israel does it of its own volition or as part of negotiations with the United States or whatever. I think the key question here, and I think this was the key problem with Sharon's entire strategy, is certainly if you looked at the massive and accelerated settlement expansion in and around Jerusalem and elsewhere in the West Bank since this engagement was announced and various other measures, it became very clear that he was unprepared to offer the Palestinians the bare minimum that would be required for them to be able to accept a peace with Israel. I mean, it was basically a strategy of seeking to further fragment territorially the Palestinians in order to be able to better control them. And that's where the problem lies. What we still need, and it's actually been missing from the agenda since the peace process began in the early 90s, is a clear attempt to achieve not just separation, but viable partition. And what Sharon had on offer was in many ways the opposite of that.
Again, Mouin Rabbani with the International Crisis Group. So there's a great deal of uncertainty, a lot of different ways of looking at these issues within Israel and between Israel and the Palestinians. In the meantime, Dennis Ross, back to you. Over the weekend, we saw some concern on your part that a new leader might have to be more aggressive with regard to Iran in order to establish credibility to Israelis. What were you talking about?
Well, what I was getting at is with someone like Sharon, whose credibility on security is already established with the Israeli public, he has much more of a capacity to look at any potential threat and, in a sense, say he's managing it. And the timing of responding or the character of the response is going to be very much of his own choosing. He doesn't have to deal with every provocation because, in a sense, he has the confidence of the public for how best to respond. A new leadership is going to be in a position where they have to demonstrate that they have credibility in terms of dealing with threats. And I was simply trying to take note of the fact that at a time when you have certainly the rhetoric of the Iranians, not to mention what they're doing on the nuclear program, being a source of increasing concern in Jerusalem, it's likely that we're going to find an Israeli leadership, a new Israeli leadership, acting on a much lower threshold and perhaps more of a hair trigger. That's what I was really pointing attention to.
Dennis Ross, a former point man for the peace process for President Clinton and the first President Bush. Uri Dromi is still on our program, former senior aide to Prime Ministers Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres. Very interested to bring you back into this conversation on this point. Do you think that Ehud Olmert or any other prime minister is going to have to establish his security credentials, and might that provide what Dennis Ross refers to as a hair trigger with regard to Iran?
I don't think so. If you look at Kadima, look at the people who are there. You have Shaul Mofaz, who's been the defense minister for years, Avi Dichter, who was running the security services of Israel. These are the people who took the brunt of the Intifada. Ehud Olmert himself has been minister for years. Shimon Peres is around, former prime minister, foreign minister. I don't think, and we have a chief of staff who is very serious and very credible, General Chalutz. The whole team looks to me confident enough not to be edgy.
Dennis Ross, back to you. The president of Iran today made some very threatening statements, said also that he hoped for the death of Ariel Sharon. What does that do to the situation in Israel, as far as you can tell?
Well, again, I do believe that you have an acting prime minister who is going to want to look responsible, but he's also going to want to look like he takes threats against Israel seriously. He's not going to rush to do things in terms of taking an initiative.
But he does have the backing of all of those people just listed by Uri Dromi.
That's right. But the fact is, if there are certain kinds of provocations, and I'm not talking about rhetorical provocations, I'm talking more about what would be, you know, if Hezbollah did something in the north right now, you shouldn't assume that the character of the Israeli response would be a more passive one. It would be a tougher one as a way of showing, look, maybe Sharon is incapacitated, but we're not incapacitated and we can act. That's, in a sense, some of what I think we have to realize. The Iranian problem was going to become more acute this year regardless, whether Sharon was fully ensconced in power as he had been or not, simply because you have the Iranians continuing to develop nuclear capabilities, notwithstanding international opposition, And you have that commingled with what is a constant stream of statements. By the way, almost every one of these statements is prepared. There are speeches. They're not just off-the-cuff remarks. They're speeches that have been drafted, and they're part of a calculation. And the more the Israelis hear him delegitimizing Israel's existence, which is the theme that runs through all of the speeches, the more they're going to be concerned that here you have someone who is creating a context in which threats against us are becoming more and more acceptable.
Dennis Ross, as always, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Mouin Rabbani, back to you, Palestinian Affairs Analyst, International Crisis Group. What about this? Do you anticipate that there will be greater tension in the Middle East in the aftermath of Ariel Sharon?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, on the specific issue of Iran, I suspect, that these things aren't planned in a day and a night. And if a decision, if an Israeli decision to seek to attack Iran's nuclear facilities has indeed been made, it would have been made in Sharon's time and is only going to be marginally affected by the change of leadership. I think a potentially more interesting case is that of Syria, where you've had the United States increasingly pushing for regime change in Damascus, and the Israelis basically having concluded that they're more comfortable with the current regime because they'd rather deal with a weaker adversary than a potentially stronger one or a fragmented Syrian entity. And this could be a case where, with Sharon basically having a much greater capacity to lead U.S. policy regarding Israeli interests, that the table could be reversed with Sharon's successor, and Israel could start adopting a more hostile attitude to Syria as part of America's strategy towards Damascus.
Uri Dromi, we have only 30 seconds remaining, but what about Syria and the possibility of a more a difficult relationship with Israel? What about the possibility of Israel having already decided to attack Iran's nuclear facilities?
No, first of all, I don't think Iran is a problem of Israel only. So, once they have nuclear bombs and the capability to launch them, it's a problem of Europe, of the West, of the oil. So it's a question of the West, it's a question of America, not only of Israel. One last thing about with relation to the Palestinian context. The problem is, or the fear is, that with this growing Iran threat, Palestinians again would think that there is a chance to eliminate Israel. It happened before 1990 with Saddam Hussein. I think we should not let this kind of thing derail the last chances of the peace process for the Israelis and Palestinians.
Thank you very much, all of you, for being with us. Uri Dromi, former aide to Prime Ministers Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, now at the Israeli Democracy Institute. Mouin Rabbani, Palestinian Affairs Analyst, International Crisis Group. Dennis Ross, former, again, a negotiator for President Clinton and the first President Bush. And our earlier guest, Yossi Klein Halevi at the Shalem Center and the New Republic. Thanks, all of you, again, for being with us today. Microsoft is the latest internet provider to shut down a website that angered officials in China. We'll hear about the cost of free expression and the role of Western business in enforcing government censorship in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Popoter's Notebook on To the Point. The internet has provided an opportunity for millions of Chinese to express their opinions in public, but the communist government still requires service providers to monitor web logs, erase banned content, and report offenders as well. At the government's request, Microsoft has shut down an internet journal that talked about sensitive issues, including relations between China and Taiwan. Rebecca McKinnon is research fellow at Harvard, co-founder of Global Voices Online. She worked in China as a journalist for CNN. Ms. McKinnon, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
What's the significance of this action by Microsoft? Is it really anything new?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what's been going on in China is that for any content provider in China to be allowed to do business, they are being required to censor user content. So, for instance, the chat rooms, the bulletin boards, and so on are all required to delete politically sensitive content from their services, and Chinese companies, of course, have been doing this for some time. But what is new about this is that MSN Spaces is not only plugging in formulas to prevent you from posting items like Tibet independence or discussing sensitive religious matters, but they actually have people going in and shutting down weblogs, in part when they see sensitive content, but also in response to requests by government authorities. And now this blogger who was shut down, who goes by the pen name Michael Anti, he had been writing extensively about a incident with a Beijing newspaper where the editor got fired because the newspaper was pushing things politically a little too much, and so there was a reorganization and the journalist walked out, and Michael Anti was supporting the right of the reporters to report the news and that they shouldn't be penalized for trying to be journalists. And what he was writing was not illegal. He was not advocating overthrow of the Chinese Communist Party. He was not advocating banned religious movements or Taiwan independence or anything like that. He was writing in support of journalists at a particular newspaper. Nothing he was doing was illegal. Then what happened was apparently, according to what Microsoft representatives have said, they received a complaint from authorities and in response to that shut his blog down without, it seems, challenging the Chinese authorities as to, you know, did he do anything illegal? They simply responded by shutting it down. It's like, okay, the authorities want it shut, we'll shut it down, whether or not that request was really legal.
We're talking with Rebecca McKinnon at Harvard, co-founder of Global Voices Online. I understand not just monitoring but and not just responding to the government, but also reporting in some cases has been required by the Chinese government. Has anybody been punished as a result of reports from service providers, whether they be Microsoft or anybody else?
Well, there was an incident earlier this year where Yahoo handed over user information of a Chinese journalist who had sent some information to an overseas dissident website, and the information was published on that website, but Yahoo helped the Chinese police uncover who this journalist was, and as a result, the journalist named Shi Tao was sentenced to 10 years in jail. And so there's a lot of controversy also as to whether American companies should be in the business of helping the Chinese government stifle the right to free speech of Chinese citizens, a right which is universally recognized by the United Nations, and a right for which some would point out many Americans are giving their lives for in principle in other parts of the world, while on the other hand our companies are helping to stifle that right in China. And so there are a number of critics, both in the human rights community and elsewhere, who feel that what companies are doing is not only immoral, but is promoting a kind of world that makes democracy and the emergence of democracy less possible.
What should they do? You said that MSN didn't challenge China when it requested that this blogger be shut down, and that Yahoo actually gave user information to China. What should they be doing instead, presuming that they want to stay in business there? I would gather they're making money.
Right. Well, there's tremendous amount of debate over whether there are lines that should not be crossed, and whether there's certain types of business you shouldn't be doing. You know, it's universally accepted that you might make more money employing child labor or paying people 1 cent an hour, but you know, we're polluting rivers, but a line is drawn, and you don't step beyond that line. And so there's now a great deal of debate about whether a line needs to be drawn with technology companies and the kind of compliance that they should adhere to with governments like the Chinese government.
We've just got a short time left.
Sure.
What do they say when you or others advocate, as you are, that they limit their activities in some way? How do they respond to it?
Well, they respond by saying that in order to be in China, they have to comply to these regulations. And to a certain extent, it is true that to do those, provide those specific services, they might need to comply to those regulations to a certain extent. But one of the criticisms is that they're not even pushing back at all. They're not saying, wait a minute, you know, we need to respect our users. We need to, is it really necessary for us to shut this down? Can we renegotiate on behalf of our users? Or are these service providers merely acting in the interests of governments and not necessarily in the interests of users in countries like China, which also opens some questions about whether these companies, when faced with perhaps an overreaching government in our country or in other countries that consider themselves democracies, might also be a little too quick to hand over our information or shut us down.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rebecca McKinnon, a research fellow, Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, founder of Global Voices Online, formerly a journalist in China with CNN, tried to blog in China herself. We'll have her come back and talk about that some other time. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Carolyn Radziner and Christian Bordahl, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alnape. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.